Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, climate change, pesticides, and mites are killing off the world's bees. What will happen to the planet's food? And can the bee colony collapse be stopped? But first, trend for economic equality in the U.S. has been changing, with less opportunity for people to transcend intergenerational economic status than they have in other countries, like Norway, Finland, Denmark, and Canada. Why the changes? Miles Korak is with us. He is a professor of economics at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa. He's the author of Generational Income Mobility in North America and Europe and The Intergenerational Transmission of Employees. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Miles Korak.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things that you have been studying is this gap between the so-called American dream and the reality, particularly with upward mobility. Perhaps what we should start with is that the opportunities for children of the privileged, what you called the 1% in your article, are quite different from everybody else. Maybe we should get a sense of how different they really are and what the primary drivers are.
In one sense, different in the amount of resources these children have, but they're also very different in kind. I think all children benefit from having more monetary resources in the household. But what's happened over the last generation or so in the United States is a very significant increase in the amount of spending that goes to what people have called enrichment expenditures amongst families in the upper end of the income distribution. They're spending a lot more money on things like computers, books, summer camps, extra tutorials, and things of this sort to increase what economists call the human capital of their children. That's just ballooned over the last two or three decades. But it's also the nature of these resources are sort of fundamentally different. It's certainly true that parents help their children at all stages of the important transitions that children go through in becoming adults, not just in the early years, but also through the teen years. And the other thing that really distinguishes the families in the top 1% is the foothold those families are able to give their children in the labor market when the children are in their late teens or early 20s. Everybody relies on networks of some sort to get information about jobs and possible job opportunities. But in the top 1%, you see a very large fraction of children actually being employed by the same employer who employs their father. So in some countries, almost 7 out of 10 kids in the top 1% actually have at some point held a job with an employer that also employed their fathers. Part of that also has to do with, you see this sort of echo in the education system. So children of the relatively well-to-do are on a different educational track through more selective high schools and colleges.
One of the other things that you've done in your work is comparative studies, comparing the United States with other similarly situated countries that are wealthy. How different are they with regards to this phenomenon?
The United States is different in the sense that the degree of inequality is much higher than in other countries, and therefore we see the amount of resources for the top 1% being much higher. So there is a significant difference in just the resources available there. But there are also differences in how those resources end up structuring fundamental institutions like the education system and the healthcare system. So in the U.S., you see a more divergence. For example, if you make a comparison to Canada, children born at the top are much more likely to become adults who are in turn raise the next generation of children at the top. And similarly, if you're born at the bottom, you're much more likely to stay in the bottom in the United States than in Canada. So there are significant differences, and I think part of that has to do with the structure of labor markets as well.
You also looked at, I think it was Denmark and Sweden. How did they compare with the U.S. and Canada?
Well, in terms of mobility, Denmark is probably the most intergenerationally mobile country where family background is very loosely associated with a child's ultimate adult success. But I think we also have to be careful in making comparisons like that. Denmark is a very different country, much smaller, not just geographically, but also much more demographically homogeneous. Some of the comparisons that I did focus on tended to be towards countries like Canada, which are also share a lot in common with the United States. But the other lesson we have from these countries is, you know, inequality has gone up, for example, quite significantly in Sweden and in Canada as well. Not as much as in the United States, but these countries have also seen a rise in the share of income going to the top 1%. Yet somehow in Sweden, for example, even though there's this dynasty amongst the top 1%, the rest of society stays relatively mobile and can still live with that dynasty. The starting point for this study was something that the outgoing chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, Alan Krueger, called the Great Gatsby Curve. That involved a comparison of dozens of countries. We've just focused this discussion on those at the two extremes, the most mobile and the least mobile. The most mobile include not just Sweden and Denmark, but also Finland and Norway. And the least mobile include not just the United States, but also the United Kingdom, Italy, and France. And then there are a bunch of other countries in the middle.
Now, if we were going to draw lessons from what Sweden does, would you say it's a public policy question or a cultural question or a behavioral one or all three?
Well, I think in this discussion, it's important to hold more than one possibility in your mind as you think this through. For me, and for the sort of the economic theories that have informed some of my work, there are three fundamental drivers of a child's future prospects. Clearly, the family is a very important institution, determining how children get a start in life and promoting them throughout their lives. But families also have to mesh with labor markets, and so the structure of labor markets also matter. The more unequal labor markets are, the more unequal wages and access to good jobs are, the less mobility there'll be. And finally, between family and the labor market is the state and public policy. Public policy can be designed to be progressive in the sense of being of relatively more benefit to the less advantaged, or it could skew things the other way and be of relatively more benefit to the advantaged. So I think we can have different opinions upon which of these institutions are the major drivers. As a labor economist, I tend to see the labor market as being the important driver and that meshes these other gears, the family and public policy. But in the United States, all three of these things or institutions are configured in a way that leads to less mobility and less opportunity for the less advantaged. Public policy tends to be less progressive. The U.S., for example, spends a good deal of money on education, but it doesn't level the playing field as much as it could. It spends a good deal of money on social policy, but it goes mostly to the elderly, older population. In the U.S., the labor market is much more unequal and much more polarized, and family structures are also more polarized.
The article that you wrote for the New York Times, you opened it with a little vignette about Jan Wenner, who is the publisher of Rolling Stone, as an example of some of these underlying dynamics. Why did you choose Wenner? And then how common is his story to America's story?
It was just one example that happened to have come up more recently. I certainly did not want to pick on him and the fact that his son now runs RollingStone.com. But it's easy to find many examples like that. As I suggested earlier, the use of families and networks is very common across the entire income distribution. But it's particularly notable amongst the rich. And I can find examples of this sort in countries like Australia and Canada and many others. But I think the point of picking up on an anecdote like this is to emphasize that opportunities aren't the same across the income distribution, but also to stress that one important aspect of rising inequality that hasn't been fully appreciated is the degree to which it forms opportunity and the degree to which it'll be passed on to the next generation. If the children of the very well-to-do are also more talented than average and have more skills, as the little anecdote seems to suggest that Mr. Wenner feels is the case, then it doesn't negatively impact on the productivity of the economy. But evidence, in fact, shows that that's, on average, not the case. So this is an example of inequality begetting inequality, not for reasons of productivity, skills, or talent, but because the playing field is not as level as it could be.
The other cultural belief that you think is maybe even holding up this continued dynamic is this belief that people in the U.S. can be upwardly mobile. Do you think this is a myth? And what do you think the costs of that are?
it's a myth might be going a bit too far. I mean, there is a good deal of mobility in the United States for the broad middle of the income distribution, but it's very sticky at the top. But to the extent that people tend to justify their position in life because of inherent talent and more skills that they have, that sort of forms our attitudes to public policy. If it's all about your own efforts and personal responsibility, then you're less inclined to support public policies to level the playing field, give the disadvantaged a stronger foothold. And the view that my article tries to address is that, that's a very important part of the American dream, that anybody can make it with sufficient energy and talent. And if a very influential part of the population believes that, those in the upper fifth, then they're much more inclined to project that on everybody else and therefore skew or structure public policies in a way that doesn't really promote mobility. In a very real sense, the American dream is still there to be had. That's why many immigrants wish to come to the United States. But what we're talking about here is sort of one's relative position in society, and opportunities are not as fluid as we often think they are as a result.
Do you think that it was once more egalitarian with more opportunities for mobility than it is today? And is that where the belief started?
The idea of American exceptionalism and the American dream has a long history in U.S. discussions. But certainly, at least some studies have found that the degree of intergenerational mobility was much higher a generation or two ago than it is now. As a result, Americans, to the extent that they continue to believe that, would be willing to accept more inequality than many other countries. The point of my article was also to illustrate that that's changed. People who grew up in the 50s and 60s faced a very different family structure, a very different labor market than those growing up in the 80s, 90s, or the early 2000s. I think there's a greater awareness now of that over the last decade or so.
If you were going to design policy from this point forward, drawing from those that are more successful in enabling people to be economically mobile, what would you say the most important ones are?
I think that's a very good question, and there's certainly a lot of discussion about that in the literature. James Heckman of the University of Chicago has pointed our attention to the very important role of the early years. So, for example, the recent proposal to extend kindergarten to four-year-olds, I think, would be a very important policy to pursue. Professor Heckman's highlighted that the return to an extra dollar of investment in the early years is much greater than in the later years. Other things that we could do certainly should be directed to supporting the family, particularly parents with the young children, trying to reduce stress loads in the family, perhaps through more parental leave or options for leave or more flexibility in daycare provisions. And the third set of policies would revolve around trying to develop a more equitable labor market in which lower-skilled jobs aren't paid as poorly as they are now.
Well, Miles Corak, thank you for joining us once again on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
When we come back, what are the causes and solutions to the Great Bee Die-Off? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Throughout much of the world, bee populations have been declining, threatening food supplies that rely on the pollinators to reproduce. Their deaths have been tied to insecticides, climate change, and killer mites. What is the latest research on the global health of the bees, and what are ways to prevent further collapses? With us are three experts. Jeremy Kerr is a professor of biology at the University of Ottawa, specializing in conservation biology and biodiversity. His latest publication links the decline in bumblebees to climate change. Peter Dearden is a professor of genetics and a researcher in the Laboratory for Evolution and Development at Otago University, where he specializes in evolution development and epigenetics. Paolo D'Souza also joins us. He is a professor and team leader at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization in Australia and the Global Initiative for Honeybee Health. He's also a collaborating scientist on NASA's Mars Exploration rover mission. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here with us. Let's start with the actual problem itself. We've been dealing with a collapse of bee colonies. We've been faced with dying off of bees. Can we get a sense of how long this has been going on and what the extent of it is? Paolo D'Souza, perhaps you can start letting us know what you know, and then we'll see what the other scholars can add to that.
There are a number of statistics done, really well done in the United States, some in Europe. Numbers from China are not, in Asia in general, it's not that clear. But for example, in the United States, back in 1947, when they started the statistics on what was going on, they had about 6 million hives. And that number came down early 80s to approximately 4.5 million hives. So they're talking about dropping 1.5 million hives in total, which would represent something around 25% of everything we had back in 47 and what we have today. This is a really solid number in terms of all the work done in the United States in terms of statistics. Across Europe, there are a number of statistics also showing numbers, and this really depends from country to country. The situation in the UK is a bit critical, as it will be in other places like in Luxembourg, in Belgium, and a few other countries that are really facing serious issues, including Finland and Sweden. Europe depends on what kind of stresses they are going through, but the statistics are really showing declines that goes from around 20 to 30% of bee decline. The best situation would be probably around Portugal, Spain, France, where they have decline, but not at that large number. So it would be between 5 to 15% of the hives over the last decade. So this is the kind of statistics you would see. The numbers fluctuate naturally as the beekeepers try to cope with the intense cold weather they have in the Northern Hemisphere. That is one of the key drivers that they have there. We don't have much in the Southern Hemisphere. The heat of coming from the intense winter they have. So they try to increase the numbers, and naturally in the spring the numbers go up, but this is not sustainable. The trend is really to see this decline steady over the last five decades.
Jeremy Kerr.
If we're going to talk about the loss of pollinators in general or bees in particular, I think it's really important for us to think about the difference between managed pollinators like honeybees, which are critical for many aspects of agricultural productivity, and wild pollinators, on the other hand. Wild pollinator species contribute to agricultural productivity very extensively and very importantly, but they are also extremely important for the pollination of plant species everywhere. So any flowering plant that occurs in nature is likely, or many flowering plants that occur just naturally, will derive benefits from the services that those wild pollinators provide or wild bees provide. Those wild bee species, there's about 20,000 bees on Earth. European honeybees are one of those species, and by far the most famous and probably individually the single most important species for pollination in a managed setting. But we have seen evidence for declines of wild bee species at least a continental scale that has gone back now several decades. And this, the magnitude of those losses among wild bee populations has begun to be sufficiently large that even though we don't monitor them anything like as well as we do for honeybees, we are starting to see those effects at an almost hemispheric extent. So you can look across North America and Europe and in a cross-continental kind of way, begin to see that the ranges of many of those wild bees are collapsing inward. So we're seeing declines in abundance, and we are seeing losses of their geographical range. And the consequence is that if you go to any particular place in either of those continents, you're likely to have fewer pollinators there today, fewer bee species there today, than were present 30 or 40 years ago. And the effect is that we are making our pollination service a little bit more wobbly and unreliable, because we know that the more species you have, the better insurance you have that you can sustain that service through an environmentally noisy period of the sort that we're going through now.
For clarification, when you talk about all the different species and the effects that this is going to have, I mean, this is really a profound effect on all of life on Earth.
We're in the sixth mass extinction right now, and that's an issue which is scientifically about as certain as we can be. And we know that we're losing species really quickly. And if we think just within bees, we think the rate of loss of bee species at a global or a regional extent is a mirror image of what we see more broadly. We hear about a lot of big vertebrates, for example, tigers, that are disappearing tragically across huge areas. But the same sorts of trends are observed among much smaller organisms like bumblebees.
Peter Dearden.
I come from New Zealand, and these terrible things happening in the rest of the world, we have clear evidence from the Northern Hemisphere that bee species in general are declining, and honeybee populations in particular are declining. In New Zealand, the situation is reflective of that, but we seem to be a few years behind. So one of the key problems for honeybees is varroa mite, which comes and predates, also vectors viruses between them. Varroa mite came to New Zealand about 12 years ago, and we've seen losses of bees, and particularly feral bees, which we think have been very important in the New Zealand agricultural systems, which are kind of unusual. So all those bees that aren't managed have sort of vanished, and we're left with only managed colonies. But alongside that, we've also seen particularly specialty honeys from New Zealand, and so the numbers of managed colonies in New Zealand are increasing. Alongside that, we don't really know what's happening with bumblebees. We don't know what's happening with native bees here, which are pollinators of our native forests. All we seem to be seeing is a reflection of what's happened in the past few years in the Northern Hemisphere.
Peter, one of the things that you have been finding is that there are an increase of pathogens that seem to be affecting the bees, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere. And you said this is no small matter. What is it you're finding?
We found that across New Zealand in particular, varroa mite has caused a change in the nature of the viruses that are present in honeybee populations and their virulence. And so that's causing problems for beekeeping. This year, we've had some evidence of a colony collapse-like phenomenon. We don't know if it's the same as being seen in the Northern Hemisphere, but it's certainly frightening. And we're just getting into spring now in New Zealand, and so there's a lot of monitoring going around. That's been associated with parasites that we've never seen before in New Zealand bees. But to be honest, the monitoring of viruses and other pathogens in bee populations hasn't been good in the past. So maybe that we're seeing increases in frequency of pathogens that are already present or new things. There have not been any bee imports into New Zealand since probably the year 2000. And so this is likely to be related to varroa mite or just increasing the numbers of particular pathogens we have. It's a difficult situation. And the problem is we have very few solutions which we could apply to try and improve the health of bees. And alongside that, what's happening with the wider pollinator community is not very well understood.
Let's see if we can analyze what all the various causes are. In the most recent days, there have been some efforts at banning pesticides, for example, that they think are behind them. But Jeremy Kerr, now you have been looking at the effects of climate change as distinct from the other killers of bees. What did you find and how did you find it?
It was something that we looked at for bumblebees, and we did it in a cross-continental way. So what we were looking at was the trends in the geographical distributions of all of the bumblebee species for which we have reasonably complete measurements of where the limits of their ranges have been found since about 110 years ago. So it was on the order of 67 species in both Europe and North America. So what we can infer is really limited to those two geographical areas. But what we were doing was thinking about global change biology in a general sense. And what we have seen at a global scale is that as climates have warmed, the barriers to the polar limits of where species are found have been falling away. So species that were in, I live in a very cold place in Canada. So as temperatures have warmed up here, the key limitation on the geographical boundaries of many species has relaxed. And this enables them to colonize areas that are progressively closer and closer to the North Pole in a very general kind of sense. So we figured that we would see something rather similar among bumblebee species. Now, a word about bumblebee species. They're the only group of bees, apart from honeybees, a single species. So the only group of bees for which we have a reasonably complete picture of where they have been found over long time periods. There are hundreds of other species in Canada, and we just don't have a clue what they've been doing. So with bumblebee species, we looked at where the northern boundaries of their ranges were. We looked at the coldest places they were found. We looked at their southern boundaries, and we looked at the hottest places they were found. And we looked at their elevational limits on both continents, Europe and North America. And what we found is a series of striking differences in how bumblebees have apparently responded as climates have changed in comparison with practically every other group that we've ever looked at, like butterfly species or birds or plants or reptiles. Bumblebee species are doing two things that are really important. The first is their ranges are collapsing inward from the hottest places in the south. So they're actually pulling north from places that have gotten hot, but that were hot to start with. The other thing they're doing is they are not tracking north. So if you go to the most northern places where they were found, those boundaries are almost fixed in place. They're not shifting north. So what's happening is that their ranges are rolling up from the south and they're getting smaller and smaller and smaller. They're doing so at a pace which is identical across North America and Europe. They're doing so at a pace which is identical in places where habitat losses are comprehensive and in places where there is practically no habitat loss at all. They're doing so in places where there is no pesticide use, and they're doing so in places where there's massive pesticide use. So the effects can't easily be explained by those other factors. The other thing that all of this kind of needs to be interpreted through the unique evolutionary characteristics of that group. Bumblebee species evolved under cool conditions. They like it when it's chilly relative to many other bees, which are kind of hot environment specialists. And bumblebee species share a kind of the more closely related bumblebee species are, the more likely it is that they have responded in a similar way to changing temperatures through time. So there is this process that we call niche conservatism in how they respond to hot conditions. So we think that reflects a role for rapidly changing climates in at least these northern hemisphere areas. But that by no means suggests that pesticides, that pathogens, and that habitat losses are somehow unimportant. Our results do not say that. And we know that that's not true from a great deal of other research.
And I would suspect that as the climate warms, that pathogens change too. As I understand, that's one of the issues, and that certain pathogens may proliferate more, which may be part of what's going on in the southern hemisphere, what Peter Dearden is finding.
That's true. One thing I'll just say about this is that basically with bumblebees and with many other bee species groups, including, we are basically hitting these things with everything we've got. And the response should not surprise anybody. Bees are declining, but it's because we are nailing them with all kinds of really serious threats that even if they were acting individually would represent a major problem. Now, what we're not doing just one thing. We're doing four or five things, and the combination is predictably very negative.
Well, that's actually a perfect segue to Paolo D'Souza. Paolo, you've been fitting bees with these little kind of like cameras to try to understand what all the stressors are. What have you been able to find out? And before that, what are these little cameras? How are you doing this and what are you finding?
We have different types of technology we're using. One is quite standard in scientific communities. So we're using RFIDs, which is just tagging bees. There are different ways of tagging bees. You can just train wings or put a little color code on the back of the bees. You can watch them leaving and coming with different types of markers that will allow you to identify individuals. With electronic tags like RFIDs, the same you would have in badges when you walk in and leave buildings, or you have in a car when you drive on a highway and want to pay the toll just by passing by a checkpoint, it's the same. So it allows us to write in those numbers, in those microchips, a very large number of combinations of numbers that would allow us to identify each one of those individuals. Because they are small, light, and we... In other words, we increased a lot the distance and communication between the microchip and the antenna. So it's not just a few millimeters, but a few centimeters. We do not miss much readings. As the bee comes in, we read many times the bee walking in and leaving the hive. And that allows us to understand better what the bees are doing. There are other types of sensors we're developing as well, sensors that can be powered by the movement of the bee. So as the bee flies, it vibrates, and we harness that vibration in generating energy. We store the energy into a micro battery that we developed as well. And you can use that energy then to power a microprocessor, which would be a little control electronics that wakes up the sensor, make a measurement of temperature or whatever you want, and then fall asleep again. And you can communicate that wirelessly. That is what our research in CSR is doing. So we're focusing on the development of the technology, and we demonstrate that by just doing field applications with entomologists that work with us. The lead for this kind of conversation is really looking at the number of stressors that we have that has just been mentioned. You go from use of different chemicals, not only pesticides or fungicides, and many other miticides and so many other things that could affect bees. And you look at different habitat losses, extreme weather events, the climate change not only changes the average temperature in regions and you can see warming a bit, but also you have extreme weather events happening with El Niño, La Niña cycles being often more intense. And that type of extreme weather with extreme droughts, and like we had in New South Wales here in Australia last summer, was so difficult for the bees that the production of honey went down, and also the pollination services became more expensive as bees were not available for everyone. But you would have also extreme weather and floods and many other things. And you go from that to pests, pathogens, parasites. You have air pollution, water contamination. You have a number of radiation being emitted around from the biofilm towers and communications or telecommunications in general. That is quite intense. There are some accounts that might affect bees in a given way. You would have different diet. It's difficult to say if which kind of genetic modified pollen would cause bees to be healthier or not, or to have more or less appetite. But that is something that's still to be understood. And also just providing one type of pollen for bees for a long period of time. So the monoculture is something that you just feed the bees with one type and they like diversity. And you can keep going with all the stresses that you have. And there are so many stresses or combination of those stresses that makes this problem really almost impossible to understand. So the whole idea that we came with was to share the technology we have with scientists around the world to use it. So we have everyone using the same technology, the same experimental or very similar experimental protocols, looking at different stressors, sharing the data in a common way. The data is exactly the same format. So we don't have one scientist storing the data into a ASCII file, the other one in an Excel spreadsheet, or the other one in a little database, or the other one in another format. So everyone has the same format. And we share this data among us, and we publish together. If somebody wants to publish something, that's fine. Just has to raise and say, I would like to publish a paper about the impact of this type of sublethal dose of neonicotinoids. Who would like to join? And then you would have scientists from Argentina, Chile, Costa Rica, Brazil, Mexico, the States, from Australia, New Zealand, join forces. Yeah, we have to look at all these different aspects. And then hopefully we will avoid a competition for small discoveries and evolve into a large discovery based and advance the knowledge about what's going on. So that is the whole idea about the Global Initiative for Honeybee Health. Look exactly at the issue, bees declining, not only, of course, the bees, domesticated bees, but also the bees that we have in landscape in general, the large number of those. Bongos is a group, Melipona is another one. We work in the Amazon in Brazil. Euglossa, for example, pollination of orchids and vanilla and many other things. In Mexico became a quite an impressive problem. And the list goes on and on. And we just have too many factors in impacting that. And it's impossible for us to get a big picture of what is causing, if there is anything we can do about it. It's like having a group of scientists bringing different pieces of a puzzle, and hopefully we will get a big picture, understanding what are the gaps for us to complete this puzzle.
Peter Dearden, why don't we start with you? Go right into solutions, potential solutions.
We've made enormous progress with selective breeding of cattle and sheep and various other agricultural animals. And so applying that effectively in modern tools and bees is something that may allow us to get through some of these problems. But the problem is it's a very long-term solution. Currently, there are technologies for making transgenic bees. If we knew how, we might be able to make them transgenic so they're better able to resist pathogens or better able to resist climate change, then that might be possible. Obviously, a massive problem with the acceptability of that technology. Certainly in New Zealand, we wouldn't be able to do the research, and we certainly wouldn't be allowed to release genetically modified bees. So I think selective breeding is a very effective and a long-term solution. It's difficult in bees, but it's something that we need to invest in. I think one of the issues we haven't perhaps talked about is insecticide use. It's all, you know, as you said, we've seen insecticide bans in North America and Europe. And they have actually shown some of the problems with that approach, and that there's now problems with the supply of particular vegetables in North America because of an increase in aphids eating crops that normally would have been treated with neonicotinoid insecticide. So it's very clear that modern agricultural production requires both insects and insecticides. And so we're trying to work on a program to identify novel insecticides which might be bee-friendly. It's a start to getting things which might improve the health of all beneficial insects, but at least it's a start to say, well, if we can find something which doesn't hurt honeybees or doesn't hurt bees, that'd be something. Again, a long-term research problem, and I don't know that we have the time really to develop these things to make a real impact when the populations of bees, particularly outside of New Zealand, are crashing so quickly.
That does seem to be the big issue, is how much time do we really have to solve this problem? Jeremy Kerr, I think it was in your work or in an interview with you where you talked about the problems of moving bees around from place to place. I know people are buying bees and stealing bees, and there are all kinds of issues related to this as well.
So what we have talked about in the context of climate change is an idea that has been very carefully described by people who do climate science research and its applications to the conservation of biological diversity. And what we're talking about is a thing called variously assisted migration or assisted colonization or managed relocation. It's got a bunch of names. I'll just call it managed relocation. And basically what that means is you push the boundaries of where a species has been found just a little bit so that it is a little bit more able to keep up with shifting climatic conditions. What it is not is taking species from, say, North America and sending them to island environments like New Zealand or Hawaii and just turning them loose. It is also not a thoughtless relocation of species from one region into a completely different region, where what you would be doing is in addition to moving the bee species, possibly introducing dangerous pathogens that that bee species carries. So there's a lot of very heated rhetoric about around managed relocation that is mostly irrelevant to its discussion. I mean, what we really need to do is have a real discussion where we're talking about what this actually is, and that is nudging the boundaries of geographical ranges so they're just a little bit more able to keep up with rapidly shifting climatic conditions. But there's a lot of tools in the arsenal here, and dealing with climate change is just one part of what we need to do. The neonic issue, as Professor Dierdness, I think, quite rightly pointed out, is quite acute and represents a serious, you know, a serious threat in at least some regions and maybe very widely.
I want to go back to this idea of bee relocation because you touched on some things that I think a lot of the general public is not quite aware of, which is if you do have a collapse of, say, your honeybees in a particular region, it's not like you can just ship in other bees to replace them. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's a dangerous thing to do that. We have seen that there have been real, quite serious pathogen introductions from Europe, for example, into wild populations of bumblebees in North America because of the indiscriminate movement of greenhouse bees in Europe to greenhouses in North America. And what happens is some of those greenhouse bumblebees escape outside the greenhouse, and then the pathogens that they carry, and although they are tested for pathogens, frankly, they nevertheless carry quite a lot of them, they introduce diseases into the new environment that they've been set to. So it's a risky proposition to start talking about taking bees from one region and sending them off to another. Because even though a lot of the time we look rather hard to see those bees are not carrying diseases, in fact, quite a lot of diseases slip through the net. And this is one of the ways in which we've introduced new strains of risky pathogens to North American bee populations. And I don't think that many people would propose that that was a sensible next thing for us to do. I mean, it's clearly caused problems in the past. So the first rule of not being crazy about dealing with a problem is you don't deliberately repeat the things that have led to disasters in the past.
And that's been a critical problem in New Zealand. Almost all of our agricultural systems are imported from overseas. Varroa mite was imported due to poor sanitary procedures with queen importation. We have enormous problems with sorts of issues. And it amuses me that actually we are also the largest supplier of bees, packaged bees, to Canada, which loses bees in winter. So it's not as if this is a problem that we don't know about, but we're still repeating the mistakes.
So what you're saying is that we are actually doing the exact thing that we should not be doing, which is sending bees to regions where they perhaps should not be going.
Well, I do think shipping from New Zealand is probably the best you can do at this point. We have not got all the pathogens that are found in other places, and we have very good systems in place to ensure it's not a problem. But there is a massive movement of bees from New Zealand to Canada in particular, and there has been movement of bees from Australia to Canada and North America because problems with climate and diseases in those places. So it's interesting that there's a trade that perhaps isn't very well examined, which is propping up the Canadian beekeeping industry. So I think it's interesting. I don't know of any problems at this point, but it's not hard to see that such movements tend to homogenize the pests and the pathogens around the world, which leaves us without perhaps particular areas which you could use as a perhaps a reservoir of genetic diversity for bees.
Just one thing that it's important to distinguish between the honeybee situation, which is a single species of a managed pollinator, and then this massive group of wild pollinators that complement what honeybees do. And if you lose a bee species in North America that isn't a honeybee, say it's some interesting and beautiful kind of bumblebee species, there is no way to fix that. It's just gone. That's it. That it's extinct. You can't just bring in another bee from some other place because it's not the same species. It's gone forever. So that's a one-way street. So if you lose a species from North America of bee, apart from honeybees, it's gone. It's like tigers.
Does that also mean that certain fruits and vegetables cannot get properly pollinated? For example, I remember certain trees that are indigenous to, say, Asia, were not really able to be grown in the U.S. without hand pollinating because of the bee situation, because the proper bees were not there for that particular species of fruit.
Well, it would be very tricky indeed if you lost your bumblebees, for example, from an entire region. They do things which are quite distinct relative to other bee species. I don't know that you could really do without them. They actually pollinate more than almost anything else because they're active over such a long time of the year. Many of our wild bee species are out for a week or 2 weeks. Honeybees are out for a more sustained period than that, and they're really valuable in agricultural settings and for some kinds of wild pollination. And then other groups like bumblebee species or big-headed bees or orchid bees, these things do very particular things. And if you were to lose them, you would lose those particular services. And it's not necessarily true that you can get them back by bringing in some other kind of bee species. The fewer species there are in a place, the less likely that pollination service is going to be provided reliably.
Paola D'Souza, you've been quiet for a while. Let's bring you back in. What would you add to this, particularly in the solution area?
There are different aspects. Looking still on the problem that, for example, bringing species from Apis mellifera has been spread over the world. We never had Apis mellifera originally in Australia. We brought here the same from New Zealand. So it's one species that we have been using more widely because we can be domesticated, have a large number of those, and we know a lot about those things. And they play a really important role in pollination in general, not only as a primary pollinator, but also secondary pollinator on many crops. So this work of pollination is really around a perfect match between bee anatomy and behavior and the flower itself. But we do have events like bringing, that happens in Brazil, when scientists brought the killer bee from Africa to study them in the lab in Brazil, and they escape. So we have two queens escaping, and they spread them what is the killer bee that we have in Brazil, what's the Africanized Apis mellifera. Very aggressive bee, and has moved a lot throughout the north of Brazil and moving south and also going to Mesoamerica up to the border of Mexico. Very aggressive bees, and they can kill people, 100 people approximately every year in Brazil, horses even they come by. So, but they are very aggressive, and they're very resistant to most of those diseases. Are you going to trade that? Let's use Africanized bees, very aggressive. Some people will die on the way, but yeah, they will be more resistant to other things. That selective breeding might be one thing. I'm not sure if that is the solution. There are many other aspects from bees that still raising the issues, not about just the food production, but what's the role of the bees in the landscape? And that is, I still quite don't know. If you look at the diversity of bees you would have in the Atlantic or in the Amazon forest in South America, so many species of plants that really like bees to pollinate. And if you don't have the plants, what are the consequences for the whole landscape if you don't have those trees? One example is a large bee. It's bigger than the bumblebee. That is responsible to pollinate the Brazilian nut. It's responsible for it. That's what she does. It's the only bee able to get into the hard flower of the Brazilian nut and pollinate them. And they fly quite a lot, from one tree to the other. But as you have one tree going down for deforestation or anything like that, the distance between the next tree is going to be just too much for that bee. So the bee don't pollinate from one tree to the other. So they stay in one tree, self-pollinating the tree, which is not the ideal situation. So when you have the seeds, you cannot plant a new tree because the seeds are not fertile anymore. So and then the whole community that is relying on the Brazilian nut to survive will have they seem that it's a quite unsustainable practice to go ahead. Like that bee, there are bees specifically designed for a specifically designed flowering. And that the role in the landscape is still unknown to a large extent. So if you still don't understand the problem, it's difficult for us to talk about solutions for that. But moving bees around seems to have a lot of questions on if that is a solution for us. That might not be yet fully understood. So what would be the whole consequences of that? The other one would be with selective breeding. It looks to be a very successful story, but also looking at the expression of some genes that might make bees invisible to varroa in a way, as they do not get so attractive to varroa. Varroa was not in the Apis mellifera, but in the Apis serrana, and they move in Indonesia to the Apis mellifera for a reason, and then they spread. So that is one thing that most of the research done in the area in Australia is looking at that as a tenancy. Designing better pesticides. Pesticides can be responsible for some extent. It could be. You can go and buy a medicament in the pharmacy to help you with one disease you have, with one condition you have, and you take the wrong dose instead of helping you, it's going to kill you. So you need to look after the application of the pesticide. It's not just the pesticide that's because it can be dangerous, but if you do not apply that correctly, then you would have a problem. So still we need to look at how this is being applied and if this is the best way to apply it as well. So it is a very complex problem in a way, but that is what we have before us. And we need to discuss more about solutions. But for that, we need to understand the problems better.
I do know on a small scale, there are cities that are getting their residents to lease out space for raising bees. But at the same time, I know that as the bees are becoming more valuable, there's becoming a whole sort of sub-industry of stealing bees, which would move them around as well. So I think we have a whole host of problems. Jeremy Kerr?
A couple things. That the issue of neonicotinoid bans has come up a couple of times, and it's very much a front burner issue for us here in Canada. It's coming up a lot in the United States, and it's already... And it's a fiercely discussed issue in Europe and indeed elsewhere in the world. Reducing the use of these pesticides is likely to have some benefit for many pollinator species. There is a lot of evidence to suggest from at the individual level, looking at individual fields, that neonics have been used in a way which kind of greatly exceeds their requirement to derive an agricultural benefit. So they're not necessarily, they haven't always been used in a very precise way. They've been used in a kind of a messy way with things like seed coatings, which spew up a lot of pesticide-coated dust, but then blows around and distributes across much broader areas than the place where the producer wants to grow something. The consequence is that this is hitting pollinator populations in places where the crops are not being grown. That sort of problem is being addressed through new technologies from the agrochemical industry, but it's also being addressed by trying to reduce the use of those kinds of pesticides. And at present, although the evidence is actually I'm not comfortable saying that bans are universally required. I don't think that's getting quite a long way ahead of the evidence. Reducing the use of neonics and trying to limit them to times when it's really critical is at least a reasonable first step, and let's see what happens next. But in terms of managing pollinators or trying to recover pollinator populations that have been declining, there's a lot we can do. We can manage the margins of fields better by including wildflowers in those areas, not plowing those areas up so that you destroy bees that nest in the ground. You can have gardens which have native wildflowers in them. Don't use pesticides in your gardens. These are all kinds of things that we can do. Bee species don't require, generally speaking, vast areas of completely natural landscape to have very healthy populations. Doing small things in small areas can have big benefits for organisms as small as bees. So my feeling is that there's a lot we can do at a very small cost with no negative impact on anything else, including the agricultural sector.
So what residents do matters. It's not just on the big policy level.
Absolutely. I have a massive number of bees in my garden, and it's so do many of my neighbors, and it's just because we plant native wildflowers. And the other good thing about native wildflowers is they're a lot tougher than those really pretty ornaments. They don't require as much water. They don't require fertilizer at all in many cases. They're fabulous, but they're really good for pollinators, and we have healthy populations of those things around here, and that's one of the reasons why. It doesn't mean that we have to do something massively different than what we've been doing. We just have to take small, sensible steps. Those can have big.
Peter Dearden.
I think this is the case. I think humans have a huge problem with insects and other invertebrates, that they tend to see them as bad things. They're scary, they're spooky, or they're icky. But so many of them perform functions in the environment and even in our modified environments, in our gardens and in agriculture, that are vitally important. I mean, we need to grow up a little bit. And I think, you know, we need to start thinking of our own gardens and our own local environments as not just, you know, a pretty park, but also a place where these insects and other invertebrates can live. By my house, there's a dog park. It's a great park. The dogs romp up and down. Everyone enjoys themselves. But in the muddy banks on the side of the stream that runs through there, we also have large numbers of native bees nesting. We have moths. And just by putting aside that land and not landscaping it in any way, you end up with an environment which is beneficial to, you know, probably kilometres around that particular park. So I think it's very easy for people to think about their own environments and their own gardens and to think, actually, let's try and encourage some of these insects and some of these other invertebrates because they are so vital to our own future.
Paulo de Souza.
It goes from of course, from what everyone said to large urban planning, peri-urban areas, and how we're going to plan urban development. That is one important aspect, and how we're going to preserve the habitats we have today and how to have a sustainable agriculture. And that precision agriculture has been a trend for a few years, and I think there are better ways to still, we can improve the way we raise crops and the way we keep them away from different issues that we have or different types of pests we have around. But I think debating, talking about this and discussing the issue, discussing policies, and it is an integral part of everything we do. And I think that's the way forward. And keep studying. I think that's really important. And try to speed up the process of learning to the applied world. And how can we really bring the things that we have learned to policy making, to decision making, to better products, better services around. It's probably the way. We need to speed up the wheels of science in a way and bring that knowledge as quick as we can to everybody's life and to everybody, every business around that would benefit from that. And also the role of landscaping in a more broadly sense.
Thank you, all three of you, very much for being with us. Peter Dearden, Jeremy Kerr, and Paulo de Souza. Great pleasure to host you. Thank you so much. Jeremy Kerr is a professor of biology at the University of Ottawa, specializing in conservation biology and biodiversity. His latest publication links the decline in bumblebees to climate change. Peter Dearden is a professor of genetics and a researcher in the Laboratory for Evolution and Development at Otago University, where he specializes in evolution, development, and epigenetics. Paulo de Souza is a professor and team leader at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization in Australia and the Global Initiative for Honeybee Health. He's also a collaborating scientist on NASA's Mars Exploration Rover mission. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to our guests, to Ankina Ghassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Mike Hurst for making today's show possible. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can always check the archives, www.scholarcircle.org or the archives at kpfk.org. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.